What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget podcast. I'm senior editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm reviews editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, we're going to be taking a deep dive into Clearview AI. This is a company that the New York Times reported on a couple weeks ago. We didn't really have a chance to mention it last week, but I think it is important to know what's up. They are pioneering scary new facial recognition technology. We're going to dive into all of that. And later in this episode, we're also going to be talking about Billie Eilish and the rise of home recording. She won several Grammys over the weekend, and I think it says a lot about what you can do with a DIY setup. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to the Engadget podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review, all that fun stuff, and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. So, Clearview AI. This is a strange company because it's basically a stealth startup that nobody had heard about over the past few years. What's up, Sherlyn?
When I first heard the name, I was definitely very confused. I was like, Clear Channel?
Clear Channel. Only Sherlyn will think about Clear Channel. And there are also theaters, right?
Isn't there a Clearview Theaters, yeah.
So here's what Clearview did. They basically went and scraped every publicly accessible image that they could from social networks, from sites like Venmo, from other websites, and they put it together with an algorithm for facial recognition technology and basically figured out a way to mathematically interpret your faces. So everyone's face becomes a mathematical formula. And by doing so, they've created what appears to be one of the most accurate facial recognition systems ever made. And what's particularly scary is that this thing has been around for only a couple of years now, but law enforcement agencies have been using it. And they've been cracking cases by basically just pulling up a photo of a perp or like a photo of something happening or a video file or something. And they're able to almost instantly match that face to a person, to their social media profiles, to something else. This is a whole new level of facial recognition technology. It is kind of terrifying. There is a lot going on here. Any thoughts, Sherlyn?
I think facial recognition software has been good. AI has been, you know, like there's people using algorithms that machine learn how to do it better for a while now. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, the scope of the resources being used here is what's so fast.
They have over
fast.
3 billion images in their database right now.
Like, it's not like law enforcement hasn't been matching people's faces in the past, but they've only used government-provided pictures from your mugshots, from the DMV or whatever.
Right. So the FBI, that's what the FBI has access to. I think I saw a breakdown of from the New York Times article. The FBI only has access to about 411 million images right now. And that is, it's a lot less than 3 billion.
Exactly. 3 billion is so much more information, so many more ways to pinpoint who it is they think was the perpetrator of a crime. And so, I mean, that's what really was shocking for me about this. Like, facial recognition doesn't surprise me anymore because it's being used in Google Photos. It's being used in your Photos library.
But the extent, the Kashmir Hill article from New York Times, I think, made a really good point. The extent of facial recognition development has actually been purposefully slowed by Google and by a lot of companies because everybody sees the potential danger here. Like, it is. This could be a nuclear bomb against privacy. This could
literally
be,
that was my thought.
This could be the end of privacy forever if we perfected this tech. Google could have done this years ago, probably. Yeah. Facebook could have done this too. Like, I'm sure they all have their secret projects that they haven't talked about, but nobody's released just recognizing somebody's face in your Google Photos album is very different than what this thing is doing.
Oh yeah, no. Yeah. I mean, but there's a lot more to this story. I mean, did you want to keep going? Because I have so many thoughts I want to say.
Well, let me just bring up, the founder is a 31-year-old entrepreneur named Hon Ton That. I may be pronouncing his name wrong. Sorry about that. But he is a guy that's sort of infamous for creating a bunch of just shitty startup ideas. Like, basically, if we did a podcast about bad startups, he had a couple. In 2009 or around then, he created something called VidiHo, which was a service that just let people spam links to their contacts. And this was actually written up at the New York Times back in the day. Jenna Wortham wrote that up on the old Bits blog, so that's a throwback. This ended up being something that also spanned Gmail accounts. Google called it a phishing scam and basically killed access, just killed the service outright. By the way, I found a really old Gawker article because Gawker covered him quite a bit. And my old editor, I worked with him at VentureBeat, my old editor, Owen Thomas, noted that this guy's Twitter profile described himself as an anarcho-transsexual Afro-Chicano American Feminist Studies major. So clearly...
What is that?
Clearly somebody who's trying to troll the libs.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know.
And the other co-founder, by the way, is Richard Swartz, who is a former aide to Rudy Giuliani. So this is a company backed by people who I think have a very different ideology compared to the rest of Silicon Valley, maybe. I'm not too surprised why they may want to go full steam ahead with facial recognition technology when everyone else is like, guys, this could be a bad idea.
They just never thought about it. They just never paused. Or if they did,
sure.
They just didn't really seem to care.
I don't think they care.
That's the other thing that really got me about the story as I was reading it, that like, okay, so I can see how... You know, these two people or whoever else was involved with the company just wanted to make something and then sell it for a lot of money. Okay, sure. Mm-hmm. I understand greed. I understand that sort of thing. What bugged me more was when the police officials, the law enforcement agency, started using it and then, like, word of mouth spread. Like,
yeah. And because it's never, so easy.
It's so easy. I get it. I get how it could be good. If you're catching someone who's definitely a perpetrator, who definitely deserves to be mm-hmm. in jail so quickly and made your life so much easier yeah. to, like, arrest this person, I see it. But why didn't you stop to think about all of the other potential bad things?
It's not their job, right? Like, I think a lot of cops just want to solve cases. So, like, Indiana State Police, according to the New York Times, solved a case within 20 minutes of searching something on Clearview. They were able to find basically a shooter and ran his face and, you know, directly tied to one of his social media accounts. And, like, that's magic. That's the sort of
yes.
magic you expect to see on, like, a CSI show or
yeah.
something.
And I don't argue against
yeah.
that. I'm not saying that, like, we shouldn't find ways to make, like, police officials' lives easier, make it easier to find people who mm-hmm. actually committed crimes. But,
yeah.
like, at some point, someone, I feel like at every stage in this
yeah.
process, everyone's going to be asking the question.
Every step of the way, by the way, of making police officers' lives easier is a knock against civil liberties. And that's something maybe the cops don't think about as much anymore. And maybe these companies that want to sell these services to cops don't really think about. One thing that I found particularly chilling, one early investor, David Scalzo, said, "I've come to the conclusion that because information constantly increases, there's never going to be privacy. Laws have to determine what's legal, but you can't ban technology. Sure, that might lead to a dystopian future
or something,
but you can't ban it." Or something? Anyway, the big takeaway here is that a lot of law enforcement companies, over 600, have been using Clearview's technology for a while. Nobody knew they were doing it, and there was really no discussion about it. And that's a shame because a lot of cities, a lot of major cities like San Francisco, have already banned the use of facial recognition altogether. But the fact that this company can exist and they think they can just do what they want, even though what they're doing, scraping images off of a lot of these social networks, is directly against their rules.
I think yeah. it's that too, right? The blatant going against all these restrictions, because Twitter also then said that, like, scraping its website for these images and to use it for facial recognition is explicitly not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
That's where a lot of us are concerned too. I have to say, like, the David Scalzo quote, I kind of agree with the early part of it, which is that, like, there's never going to be privacy. Like,
well,
that's
sure,
what we're
sure,
learning.
Sure. That's what we're all fighting against
yes.
is, like, this constant erosion against privacy. But yeah, the thing is, okay, are you going to do something to help maintain it? Or are you going to profit from the fact that, you know, there are all these lax regulations around privacy right now? It seems like, you know, that's what they're going for. I think at the very least, this whole thing shows that we need better federal regulations.
Much better regulation.
We need people in the government who actually understand technology to understand the potential of something like this, because it is terrifying. Because let's think of, like, the worst case scenario here too. Like, right now it's just cops using it, but a cop who wants to stalk someone, maybe an ex-girlfriend or something, or wants to figure out, like, who's this new, you know, guy my girlfriend is hanging out with, like, they can instantly look up information about people. The New York Times found evidence of code that would tie into augmented reality glasses. So imagine, like, just walking down the street and doing a full-on Terminator heads-up display or RoboCop thing of, like, just getting instant identification of everyone you're seeing. Like, this stuff is not just the future. It's not just science fiction anymore. Like, a database like this is pretty much here. Those glasses don't exist yet, but it's not going to be long. Like, we've already seen Google Glass. That failed. But we're going to get there eventually.
It's
so,
very, like,
yeah.
I don't know if it reminds you of that Bryce Dallas Howard episode of Black Mirror. But it's basically that with all the saturine colors and the, like, positivity-ish.
Yes, sure.
I, oh, God. Like, the potential for this to go so wrong.
So wrong. Well, here's one thing. So when Kashmir Hill was exploring and talking to police, apparently, so she was talking to police to have them run her face in the database. Apparently, Clearview started contacting those cops and be like, are you talking to the press?
Right.
Which is just...
So clearly they know. They're looking at the searches. Uh-huh. It flags things in their system on their end. So even the law enforcement officials, if they're just randomly searching for maybe a witness to a crime, that triggers something on Clearview's site. They know. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that's why we need regulation, because this company now has all the power.
Yeah.
And it's up to them. And also, speaking of that company, it's problematic as hell, because who else is involved with this company? Peter Thiel,
who is an early investor. His quote to the New York Times says he's not involved with the company, but he did give the CEO $200,000. But Peter Thiel has his fingers in, like, so many nefarious things.
He's bankrolled a ton of crap.
A ton of crap. Well, I mean, early investor in Facebook, but also he created Palantir, which is this, like, weird big data, anti-terror, anti-crime. Like, a lot of people, we don't know what Palantir does, but it basically uses big data and analysis to basically help prevent terrorism. It's something the CIA uses. The CIA's venture arm had invested quite a bit in Palantir. It's a weird, cloudy company. We don't know what's up. Peter Thiel helped fund the lawsuit for Hulk Hogan that killed Gawker. Peter Thiel is also, I believe, behind Palmer Luckey's Border Patrol startup. There's a lot of stuff. I mean, this is also the guy that he's investing in life extension and age extension in so many ways. He funded Aubrey de Grey's crazy research. And if you've seen Aubrey de Grey, he's been featured in Wired or, you know, just so many magazines. He looks like a weird cross between Rasputin and Gandalf. He says he's working on ways to stop aging forever. It sounds like garbage, but it's not surprising that Peter Thiel is funding something like this. And also, like, this is a guy who was also tied to Peter Thiel, is tied to the whole, like, figuring out ways for older people to take in the blood of young, healthy people to stay healthy. That was never proven, but there are a lot of, like, breadcrumbs pointing him to it. And it was something Silicon Valley, the TV show, made fun of even. That's Peter Thiel. That's kind of what he does. So maybe he's
not directly involved, but him bankrolling this does not give me a lot of hope at all.
Peter Thiel, also on the board of Facebook, and this company is directly doing something that's against Facebook's terms of service. So they're excused, by the way, like, when people brought up, like, oh, you're not supposed to do that. The CEO just said, well, other people are doing it, and no one said anything yet, which is the great philosophy of every technology visionary, I guess.
I mean, not just the fact that there's questionable people involved in this, but also the fact that the technology is not necessarily proven yet. You can't, like, it's not proven that it's accurate all the time.
They say it works 75% of the time, but nobody else has tested their tech, so we don't know.
So, like, we're supposed to trust that this is going to match. Like, also, what algorithm are they using? Is there going to be, like, bias for certain, like, I don't know, skin types, certain face shapes?
People who look alike. Al Ghadari, a privacy professor at Stanford Law School, said something really interesting to the New York Times. He said, it's creepy what they're doing, but there will be many more of these companies. There's no monopoly on math. Absent a very strong federal policy, we're all screwed.
Yep.
That is not a...
It's not
very
a glowing
hopeful quote. Yeah.
I mean, I felt this way for a while, so it's not that I'm surprised by this quote. But this just coming to light actually makes me just more convinced that, like, yeah, my face is in every database ever. Yeah. And, you know, if you just don't, it's like, it shouldn't be this way, but it almost is like, if you don't want something out there, don't put it out there.
Yeah, it's too late for the vast majority of us, too. Yeah. So it's like, I believe the CEO was like, well, we were considering a way to let people untag themselves from our system. Like, sure, yeah. Don't
it's
trust anything these people are saying. Also, they're based out of the WeWork in New York, so they're actually not far from this office. Oh. We need to just go walk over there.
The other thing is, this ties into also Amazon's, like, the Ring camera stuff. Mm-hmm. All of the stuff that's already looking at us can now be tapped, because apparently even if Amazon had a policy against using that footage by Clearview, Clearview's just going to be like, oh, screw you, everyone's doing it, so I'm going to do it.
This is sort of an opening of the floodgate. So I think that quote from the privacy professor is really telling. Like, even if we stop Clearview, even if somebody, like, just says, no, you can't use this service anymore, you can't use our data, somebody else is going to do it. The floodgates are open. The Ring cameras are one thing, but now if, like, you can automatically identify exactly who's who, like, if somebody is approaching your door and you can get a quick, like, oh, this person was in jail, is now ringing your doorbell, what are you going to do? Yeah.
The augmented reality glasses bit of it is the worst. Like, oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone you look at, there's no more privacy.
Anyway, please read the New York Times article about Clearview AI. We're going to be following up on all of this. I think it's important to think about facial recognition because a lot of people, I was looking at the comments in the New York Times article and people are like, hey, this sounds great. I want great facial recognition. I want it everywhere. I want to be able to quickly detect me. I want it to know who people are.
Those are the people who would use this to stalk exes.
Yeah, for sure. There's also, I think we're getting to the point where we need to think deeply about a lot of our technological advancements. And we just have not. The tech companies won't because a company like this, all they want to do is, like, make something big, make something profitable, sell it to governments, make a big exit at some point. Like, this is a guy who's been trying to make it big in tech, not by thinking about what it means or deeply. He just wants something to win.
Yeah. I mean, and to that point, I will have to give the companies that have been able to do this and then refrain from doing it some kudos. Like, thank you for thinking about it. But now we're kind of, now help us. Help us prevent this from becoming.
It was sort of like the people behind the Manhattan Project, except there was no World War II happening. So it's like Google's like, well, we could do this, but are we ready for this? And the aliens are like, are they ready for this yet? I don't know. Anyway. Speaking of, you know, terrible privacy concerns, we've seen several stories this week related to all of this. Avast, the antivirus company, has been selling user data left and right.
Again, not something that surprises me because, like, I feel like my doctor's office does it whenever I fill out a form.
Sure,
you know what I mean?
Sure.
But yeah, terrible. Like, Avast being a company that you wouldn't think would do it because their whole thing is security and privacy.
Security. Well, yeah, never trust any virus companies. I think also... I mean, given all the McAfee, not spyware, but the McAfee, like, bloatware that's been installed in so many computers lately, like, even newer computers, like, that new HP Spectre X360 I was testing came with McAfee, it came with a VPN app, which I'm like, guys, we don't need to pre-install this. Anyway, it's not great. The Avast story is just kind of sad and disappointing. I will say, pro tip, you probably don't need any virus software. Windows has gotten really good. Windows Defender, keep yourself up to date. Be wary of what you're opening from your email. Don't go to privacy. You know, don't go to weird torrent sites, even though I know you want to. I'm looking at you, Sherlyn. Don't go there. Just stay away because that's how you get infected.
Just be very careful. I mean, I'm not going to go as far as to say you don't need antivirus, but things have improved to the point where your browser
Windows has built-in antivirus.
Things.
Yeah. Mac OS has done better about stopping apps from, like, doing stuff.
In general, things have gotten better, but... Yeah, don't install bloatware.
Don't install bloatware. And be careful with Avast. I don't know what's going to happen here. So this was a story co-reported by both Vice Motherboard and PC Mag. Really nice to see, you know, big tech sites diving into stories like this.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned something about medical records, Sherlyn. Like, I wonder, why should you be worried about your medical records being shared?
Well, I'm worried because this week we also learned that a health records company called Practice Fusion is also using your data to push addictive painkilling drugs to your doctors in the hopes that they'll prescribe it to you.
Not like we're having an opioid crisis or anything.
No, yeah, not like that's not a thing right now. So, yeah, there you go. Really, really garbage fire this week.
Garbage fire. And this is also why we don't have, like, a unified healthcare database of any kind because, like, we can't even – these companies are behaving so badly. But, like, yeah, when you want to go somewhere and you want to share – your records with another doctor or specialist. You can't.
You can't.
You got to go get a paper record.
Do
gotta
not,
love it.
Do not get me started on how broken the American healthcare infrastructure is.
So broken.
Yeah.
So broken. I will say a lot of our complaining about these tech companies, it does seem like things are finally starting to happen. Facebook's oversight board, which they announced in December that they'd be putting $130 million behind a board to deal with content oversight, they're going to start hearing cases this summer. And they say it's going to be, you know, a board made up of people who use Facebook, not like typical Silicon Valley people. I'm not quite sure what that means. And I do not trust Facebook at all to get this right. Like, I feel like it shouldn't be Facebook doing this. I feel like there should be some independent oversight. Facebook is such a weird big company now, and they have so much influence and so many users. Like, they have more power than most countries. I don't know. I feel like we're going to need new rules to deal with countries this big or start having ways to break them up because we can't trust them.
The giant takeaway is we just need regulation. We need authorities to be like, look, we need to get informed about this, about what's possible and what's already happening, and just really crack down on it.
quick update on this news. After we finished recording, Avast announced that it would be shutting down its JumpShot subsidiary, and it apologized to users, saying that they want to be vigilant about users' privacy. That may be a bit tough to swallow, given that back in December, Firefox also pulled two of their extensions for collecting more user data than is necessary. So clearly, Avast has a lot of work ahead of it to regain user trust.
Duh. This past weekend was the Grammys, and, you know, controversially or otherwise, Billie Eilish actually swept up pretty much all the awards. And doing so, actually, with an album that was produced out of her bedroom studio with her brother in their parents' home, which is just kind of encouraging for a lot of, like, home studio people like myself.
It's the DIY dream.
So I, you know, wrote an article that got published this week about her achievement. Prove that, yeah, we can all do it. But I got a lot of reactions on Twitter because people hate Billie Eilish or also hate the Grammys. And you know what? That was not the point of my article. I kind of want to just like say for the record that I did not ever in my article say whether or not I liked her at all.
It's okay. You don't have to defend against random
trolls. I know,
but
I just feel so like annoyed that people miss the point. But that's the internet, right? People
always like what you like, people. It's easy.
So we're going to talk about how much easier it is today to set up your own home studio. And joining us just to talk about this is managing editor Terrence O'Brien. Hello.
Oh, hi, guys.
Hello.
And you'll also hear from producer Ben Elman because obviously he has thoughts. He's the guy who makes us sound the way we sound on this show. Duh.
So for the last few weeks, I've been walking around and just going to myself, but it's only like 40% Billie Eilish, and it's really 60% Seth Everman.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Seth Everman.
Uh-huh.
I mean, first of all, I'd like to like share a little behind the scenes with everybody. This story was not my idea. I have to give full credit or blame to Terrence.
I'll take blame. Blame.
It's blame.
Blame is fine.
We
yeah.
should just list Terrence's email so all that hate can go straight to Terrence.
Because
too.
He deleted himself off of Twitter so no one can get angry at him online.
Well, to be fair, I didn't delete myself off of Twitter. I just decided I wasn't using Twitter anymore. And then Twitter took the decision whether or not I could return away from me.
I don't know. I feel like you deserved it.
That's fine.
That's a personal opinion.
We don't need to go into why I'm not allowed on Twitter anymore.
But yeah, no.
That's another show.
So Terrence got that idea and, you know, like asked if I think that, you know, I like to tell the whole world that I'm your favorite. But I am. And of the people that you manage on this time zone anyway, I feel like I would have been the right person to pick it up anyway.
I'm right here, Sherlyn.
No, I was the best person to pick it up.
Wow.
And that's it. I'm the most musical other than Terrence and maybe Billy.
And by best, really what she means is she was the most willing.
Sure.
I mean, I wasn't really willing, but I was like, all right, you know what? Music, audio equipment, and Billie Eilish and Grammys, I'll do it. So anyway, let's just tell y'all what happened, right? So Billie Eilish won a whole bunch of awards, including Best Record of the Year, Record of the Year, Song of the Year, Album of the Year, Best New Artist. And then Phineas, her brother and producer, won Producer of the Year. The album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go, also won like Best Engineered Non-Classical and also Album of the Year. It's a ton of awards.
Let me just say, looking at this from the outside, I'm like, listen, I've seen Billie Eilish videos. I've heard some of her stuff. I was like, this is fine. At first, I was like, who is this 12-year-old on YouTube that everybody is loving? But she's good. And Aaron Tsipouris, one of our UK guys, really explained to me like why she's interesting and why the production is great. But looking at this from the outside, it does seem crazy. I do feel like that time when Arcade Fire won the Grammys and everyone was like, who is Arcade Fire?
So you're the old guy on the other side of that now?
Yes, definitely.
So some of the tweets I got were like, the Grammys are terrible. Billie Eilish has no talent. I'm like, look, when you're 18, recording out of your bedroom, you tell me how easy it is to win a Grammy.
She started at much younger, too, wasn't it?
She first came on my radar, I think, when she was like 15. She had that track with Vince Staples, Burn. That was when I first kind of heard of her. And Ocean Eyes was even before that. And that's like also a really amazing track. But yeah, she's been at this for a long time.
Yeah, and she's not like completely untalented. She's got chops. Like if you listen to the technicality of her singing, she has skills.
She doesn't sound like auto-tuned to hell
at
like
all.
So many other folks.
Yeah.
Not compressed, not auto-tuned. And so getting to the real seed of this, it's not that there hasn't been home-produced records
sure.
that have done mm-hmm. really well and that have maybe won a couple of Grammys. For example, Grimes' breakthrough album in 2012, Visions, was done entirely in GarageBand, which for anyone who's used GarageBand is shocking.
It's a pain.
But 2019 was a huge year for home-produced music really like becoming a global phenomenon. We've got Billie Eilish's record produced in their parents' bedroom. We've also got Lil Nas X and Old Town Road because Lil Nas X was like sleeping on his grandma's couch or something. His producer, Young Keo, used just like a market-friendly FL Studio license. the lowest level FL Studio license and a very well-placed Trent Reznor sample. Mm-hmm. And it became the new longest-running Billboard number one. Ran for, what, 17 weeks, 18 weeks? Ousted Mariah Carey? In fact, it was the only reason that Bad Guy did not hit number one on the Billboard charts earlier.
And just on that, too, like, one of the more interesting things to me about Old Town Road is not only was this some guy just, like, making beats probably also in his parents' bedroom with an affordable version of FL Studio, but Lil Nas X got the beat off of, like, a marketplace for $25.
Yep.
It wasn't like he didn't go into a studio with a producer and record a song. He went online, paid $20 to this dude and said, I like this track, I'm going to rap over it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely one of those marketplaces where you're kind of afraid that you're going to get a virus, too. I don't think that I've ever seen a rap beat marketplace that didn't make me feel like I needed to wash my computer afterward.
Yeah. I'm going to leave most of this discussion up to you guys, the music experts, but I do want to throw a shout out to the New York Times features. Their music section, they do this great thing where they basically FaceTime an artist and do this video feature about how did you come up with this song. They did it for Rosalia. They did it for this Billie Eilish song, too, so and Old Town Road.
Mm-hmm.
So it is that's a great feature. It really breaks down the complexities of music artistry for people like me who don't know everything.
Anyhow, whether or not you like her music, there's a lot of ways that you can set up your own home studio already. So like quickly after my article got published, Terrence incredibly quickly published his guide to home studio gear, right? And so if you want to read that, it's already on the website. But yeah, I mean, we thought we might just go into it a little bit more. If you're an aspiring, I don't know, singer, podcaster, and musician, and you want to do it all from your own home, and you have what, like a decent budget? I mean,
you
kind of
just need, you need a room and then move on from there.
That's what Devendra is telling you. But let's hear from Terrence, who actually has a studio.
I do. I use that term very loosely. I have a studio, in quotes. I would say, honestly, you don't even really need a room.
Yeah.
I don't have a room.
Mm-hmm.
My studio is a wall in my living room. So this is like a shared space. I just like all of my stuff is shoved behind a baby gate. Really, all you need is a computer. I'm not relying purely on my expertise here. I talked to a bunch of people who have home studios who record music professionally for this piece, and every single one of them said the most important thing you need is a computer.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you have a computer, you can make music. Everything else, while nice, is kind of optional.
Really? Like, not even a good mic to sound good?
So in my piece, if you read it, I highlight.
Clearly, I didn't.
you clearly didn't, Sherlock.
Wow.
Thank you.
I have
Thank
actual
you for
work
patronage.
To do, Terrence.
A buddy of mine recorded an entire album using GarageBand on his iPhone and the wired headset that came with iPhone.
Oh God.
Ben is having a seizure right now. Yeah. Ben is on the floor.
It sounds surprisingly good. So here's what I'll say: is when it comes to that sort of stuff, obviously, if you want to record a pop masterpiece in the vein of Billie Eilish, that setup is not going to work for you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you know the limitations of your gear, you can make the most of it. You know, that this is not a clean vocal album that my friend recorded. It is, that vocal is fed through a lot of effects. There's a lot of stuff going on to make it very electronic and 80s sounding and kind of synth poppy, but it works in that context. And, you know, the sound of his guitar, again, has to kind of play into the lo-fi reverby nature of recording something through a phone headset, but it works. If you know the limitations of your gear, you can get a lot out of it.
That's really important to mention. If you're not going to be spending multiple thousands of dollars on a microphone, you might not get the perfect sound, but you're going to be within shooting distance, you might need a plug-in or two, or you might just need to use EQ. Really, like, use the stock EQ that comes in whatever DAW you have and just play around with things until they sound good.
It's What's a DAW?
Digital Audio Workstation.
Thank you.
So, Terrence, run us through your studio.
Well, my studio is a little bit weird, so let's just keep that in mind. It's been cobbled together slowly but surely since I was about the age of 15.
Oh, wow.
So, 100
years centerpiece
ago.
Of my the centerpiece of my studio is still a Tascam 4-track cassette Portastudio.
Nice.
I love this thing. It is amazing. Ugh. The preamps sound great. Also, I do a lot of like manipulating tape loops and stuff, so I use it for that. But that's like my go-to mixer for everything. All of that runs into a Scarlett 2i4 audio interface from Focusrite, and into my Dell XPS 15, which is probably the newest addition to my studio, because I had been using a 7-year-old ThinkPad for a while that really had seen better days.
Was that last year's XPS 15? I seem to remember you got it recently, right?
Yes, this is. I bought this last year, late last year.
After you read my review.
So that's, that's kind of the core of my studio. As I'm sure a lot of people can probably guess just listening to me talk, I don't have a great singing voice.
I know.
So I don't really do a lot of vocals. The mic that I do use if I do record vocals is this guy that I'm in front of right now, which is a Blue Microphones Spark, I want to say.
Wow.
I kind of forget.
You're really an expert on this.
It's like they're like $100 XLR condenser mic.
We have to get you a new microphone, Terrence, for sure.
Well, yeah, it's primarily aimed at like streamers and like podcasting. But again, I'm not singing too much. I'll use it occasionally to track guitar. And then also I have a pile of like Shure SM57s and SM58s, which are not great for doing vocals unless you're going to be fronting a punk band, basically.
Now, Shure SM58s are better known as just the microphone that you find absolutely anywhere. If you're going to show up to like any kind of show, like you said, like a punk show or something, those are the super durable microphones that punk singers are like cheese grating their teeth on. They're also the microphones that are at literally every school auditorium. They're cheap, they're durable, they're just like in that sweet spot where everyone who needs just a microphone is going to have an SM58. You've definitely touched one in your life.
I'm just going to jump in and say that I use the Audio-Technica AT2020 that Billie Eilish also used to record the early tracks in that album. And while writing this article, and we were talking about this before we started recording, but like while writing this article, I was very concerned about the idea that like a $450 subwoofer was considered affordable, because I always think about like a struggling kid or like a person who maybe doesn't live in like New York or whatever. How is that affordable?
So you start somewhere.
Yeah, you do start somewhere. So for me though, like then I thought back to my like when I bought my AT2020. I remember I was like, I don't know, 21 or something. I barely had any money.
Everybody tell your first AT2020 stories.
Because
I also, that was my first podcast real mic, the AT2020 USB. It was about $180 back then.
Exactly. Yeah. I bought it for like, well, $200 Singapore back then. I bought it in Singapore and I dragged it all the way to America with me. I haven't parted with it yet. And I mean, I had saved up for a while for it. And yeah, it's within reach. Like,
Also throw out there, like there is a spectrum of diminishing returns. Like you spend enough and you get really good quality. And then after that, you're spending a lot more to get much better. So I feel like the AT2020 is that nice sweet spot. It's a big leap over, you know, $100 or $50 mics. But you got to go much higher to get much better quality.
The defining thing about Billie Eilish is her voice. So Sherlyn talked about her favorite microphone. Maybe I'll say a little bit about my favorite podcasting microphone, which is the Shure SM7B. You will find this in every podcast room built after, let's say, 2015 or so. With the big groundswell toward people being interested in podcasting, there were a lot of folks who asked longtime radio people how to build a studio, and we all said the Shure SM7B. I know that my personal audio guru, a guy that I've worked at a studio with for a few years now, has said that he put a SM7B right next to one of our studio's Neumann U87s. The Neumann U87 is a $3,500 microphone that is just the standard workhorse for NPR broadcasters. Mm-hmm. And he said he could barely tell the difference. So if you're looking for something that is really, really good for a fraction of that cost, SM7B retails new for $400.
That's not bad. I've been using, by the way, the Shure PG42, which sold for like $250, and it sounded like a decent upgrade from the AT2020.
You know, just two quick pieces of advice for anybody who's like really just getting their feet wet in producing music at home. Two temptations to avoid. A, avoid the shortcut of buying a USB microphone. Do not do it. Buy an audio interface and buy a traditional microphone. The interface is going to give you a lot more room to grow and a lot more flexibility. If you just go out and buy a Yeti mic and plug it into your computer, like, it'll get the job done, but that's kind of what you're stuck with.
USB is good for podcasting. I will say that. If you're just podcasting from your end, you want to go bring your mic somewhere or bring it to a hotel, that's great. But yeah, beyond that, get an interface.
Oh, if my Yeti wasn't currently out on loan, I'd be using it to talk to you right now. Mm. And then the other thing, don't go out and buy studio monitors, and especially don't go out and buy expensive studio monitors. If you're making music at home in a bedroom or like I am, hiding behind the couch in the living room, a pair of headphones is a much better option, and it's much more affordable. And a pair of $100 headphones is probably going to get you a better mix, better sound, and more accurate frequency response than a $300 pair of studio monitors.
There's the standard Sony headphone that has been in use since like the 70s and 80s. The Sony MDR-7506.
The very headphones I am wearing at this moment.
Yeah. I have a pair at home. They're great. They're neutral.
They're cheap. They're great. Yeah. They're under $100.
You can repair them. The individual components, you can take it apart and like replace the individual things. It's kind of great.
Right. So, well, anyway, thank you for coming on, Terrence, to tell us all about how to do this the pro way. thanks for joining
us. Semi-pro way.
Semi-pro. Yeah. Amateur way. Thank you for having me, everybody.
Get back to work.
Thanks, Terrence.
So let's move on to what we are working on next. I'm talking to a bunch of people about our move towards bezel-less screens, and specifically in laptops, so having a couple of conversations with Dell about their Infinity Edge screens, but as a broader trend too, like I do feel like we're seeing TVs get there. Samsung showed off a almost zero bezel TV at CES. I'm going to be exploring like what that means and our desire to have a screen without any borders. Clearly, there's some sort of deeper argument or something to have there. Anyway, I hope I will be able to figure that out by next week.
Phones also have that, but I think on phones, the lack of bezels altogether is harder because it leaves you less room to
phones
hold.
Phones and tablets, you need something to hold. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just published a piece about Bitmoji TV, which is launching this weekend. And it's basically another spin on made for Snap TV shows, but it places you in, like, as a star of the action. So it's kind of like a Futurama episode starring you.
Your ugly Bitmoji
and one of your friends. Anyway, that just published.
Am I the only one that feels like Bitmoji are just a crime against the internet and humanity? They're really ugly. They're just bad drawings.
I think the art could be a bit better, but I have mine. It barely looks anything like me. I don't even use it anymore because I don't have Bitmoji stickers on my phone. But anyway, after Bitmoji TV, I will be swamped in February with Samsung and MWC. Like, it's just ramping up from here. You might not hear a lot of me from here on out for the next month on this show, actually.
Well, except for the episode you may be doing.
Maybe.
We'll see.
And
as for things keeping us sane, art and gadget picks, this week I've been just spending a little time with some games I've meant to play for quite a long time. There's Indivisible, a game that was crowdfunded several years ago by the creators of Skullgirls, and it's a sort of like action RPG. It's interesting because it's hand-drawn art. It looks beautiful. Mm. It's set in like a Southeastern Asian country. It pulls in a lot of like Indian and Buddhist culture. Like it's doing a lot of things that I really enjoy. And as an RPG, it also is really wild too. It reminds me of like Valkyrie Profile. Mm. This is getting deep, but like just the combat is very different. It's not like Final Fantasy. It is almost like a fighting game. Like some of the just countering moves against enemies, you need like rapid response. Last night I was fighting a boss. It took me an hour of just like chipping away at this HP. It's not like a laid back hour. It's like me like really being up with my response timing. So that was fun. I wish it was better written. But it's a good looking game, and I really am a sucker for 2D side scroller Metroidvania type things too. It's not just an action RPG, it's also a Metroidvania, which is fun. I'm also putting time into Kentucky Route Zero, which is a game basically we've been waiting almost a full decade for this entire series to be completed. But after several years, the final episode is out. It's also now the TV version is on Switch, PlayStation 4, all the consoles. This is a point and click adventure. It's about, I don't know, search for life, search for meaning. It is sort of like an anti-capitalist screed, similar to Disco Elysium as well. It's really good. It's like a fun visual novel too. So I'm playing it on Switch just because I can take it anywhere and also play on my TV if I want. I'd recommend it to you, Sherlyn.
I know.
I like these. It's like it's a little like ghostly. It's a little creepy, but it's really interesting. It has such a great style. So Kentucky Route Zero, everybody, check it out. Jess Condit wrote up a good piece about it for us at Engadget.
I love Jess. I also love just taking a break and leaning back on my couch and reading. Just something lo-fi. And my pick this week is a book that I haven't read in a while, but I, you know, reread about 20 times when I first read it. It's called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone by Lori Gottlieb. It's a book about, well, Lori Gottlieb herself is a licensed therapist. And it's about her going to talk to a therapist for her first time after a while, after like something happens in her life. And it really explores like what people experience when they enter in a session like this. She talks about some of her patients as well as her own experience with her therapist, and kind of like that whole like, is he thinking about me like this, is he thinking about me like that? But then she also takes you on a journey of like sort of self-discovery, but it also helps you identify like things that people do. So for example, when like someone's yelling at you, they're not necessarily yelling at you, they're perhaps projecting, or it's about their own insecurities. And it's like stuff like that that she really describes in very situational ways that like help you understand some of these things. So it's kind of like going to therapy without going to therapy, and I really recommend it for anyone that's like getting through any period.
That's
of
fun. Dark, your first like, steps times. Towards actually going to therapy.
Yeah, I actually started reading it after I went to therapy. It was weird because like I was like, oh my god, this is what my therapist is thinking.
Oh boy.
I need to behave differently. This is the word I can throw at him. But it's a really good read for those who are looking to understand themselves and others better. Well, that's it for the episode today, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, and I podcast about movies and TV at slashfilm.com. Check out the Slash Filmcast there.
If you want to tell me all the things you learned in therapy, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Sherlyn Lowe. Email us all your feedback at podcast@engadget.com. Please leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. And then come back next week for a fresh new episode. She checked that thing off for a headache. Let's give her some opioids.
Was there an example?